Hello, everyone. My name is John Williams, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Institute of Leadership and Management. And I welcome you to our monthly podcast show, Leadership at the Edge, where we share ideas across the community of leadership practice in every context, everywhere. Each month, I'm joined by senior leaders from around the world to discuss their real life experiences, to challenge some of the outdated leadership practices, and to offer a fresh take on the issues that today's leaders face. We invite you to join the conversation via social media using the hashtag Leadership at the Edge, or to send a voice message via the podcast page on Anchor with your questions to our guest. To register for future podcasts and events, visit our website, instituteLM.com, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast series and leave a review. So in this episode, we'll be discussing the crucially important topic of women in leadership, and I am privileged to have leadership coach and mentor Penny DeValk as my guest. Working across sectors in North America, New Zealand, Europe, Penny works with individuals and organizations to help build the capability and confidence of talented women to support their advancement, and is a seasoned executive with decades of international experience as a CEO of high-growth organizations, working in the leadership development space for much of that time. A qualified coach and expert commentator featured regularly in the media, Penny is an inspiring speaker and facilitator with a strong reputation as a thought leader in the gender diversity arena. So who better to share their expert insights and advice on the leadership development of women? Penny, welcome.
My great pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's really, really nice to have you here. It's really nice to have somebody with your background and experience and expertise, actually, to have a conversation with. And I thought we might start just thinking about leadership in general, and which I'll call them newly recognized qualities of leadership do you think have emerged over the past couple of years?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think... certainly, I think when the pandemic came out, there was a lot of noise and interest in compassionate leadership, understandably, because people were very conscious about who was taking care of them. But, you know, we've had this conversation about often in leadership, we go for that bright, shiny thing that's new, and people, you know, latch from one to another. But, you know, Seneca 2000 years ago was talking about leadership, about power and principle, and those were really very, very clearly articulated. But I think the interesting thing, when rather than just go, oh, you know, well, we've done authentic leadership, or we've done situational leadership, that all of those things that we really need to be able to have a repertoire of leadership capability. And you know, let's listen to when people are interested in a type of leadership. It's just not about, well, sells good books at the airport. But, you know, what we've seen, say, for example, authentic leadership has been something that for the last 5 or 6 years, and I see that being a bellwether for people losing trust in organizations and in institutions and in leadership. So now, you know, so we need to listen to it wisely, what those things are. But I think we need to be careful in the leadership development space not to just jump from one to another, because the real hard stuff, which is in leadership and leadership development, is how do we build a repertoire of skills that we're not on autopilot, that don't just play to our strengths, that are appropriate for the context within which we need to impact as leaders.
Yeah, and you actually, you mentioned there, Penny, authentic leadership, and how actually that's a bellwether for the loss of trust that we saw emerging over the course of the before the pandemic, maybe. And perhaps revisiting some of that during the course of the pandemic. That we, as the Institute, we have five values of leadership, and authenticity is one of those. Do you think, although it's become I hesitate to use the word cliche, it's become a very common and topical term in association with leadership, do you think it still has that reality, that resonance with how leadership should be delivered?
I think it does. And I also think, John, that we can get caught in a bit of a trap around authenticity, because if we think authenticity is just about doing what comes naturally, well, I don't agree. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we have to get comfortable with our discomfort when we are learning to be good leaders. So just mm-hmm. doing what comes naturally, if we all did that, none of us would have ever learned to drive.
yes.
Or, you know, authenticity is about, well, I don't suffer falls, I'll say it as it is. Mm-hmm. Well, in leadership context, well, you might just have to suffer that fall in yep. terms of the bigger game. So it's, if authenticity is about, I just do what comes naturally, mm-hmm. I don't agree that's right. If authenticity is about people knowing that you're the real deal.
Right.
And I think certainly in some of my practice, I see women in particular thinking, oh, well, if I have to do things that don't come naturally, or mm-hmm. I have to be deliberate and intentional about them, then people are going to think I'm a fake, and I don't want to be a fake.
Right.
No one wants to be a fake. Mm-hmm. You know. And anyway, you can spot a fake. You yep. know, you and I can yep. spot a fake. Yep. A million miles away. So I think there's, again, a tension mm-hmm. between being authentic, which mm-hmm. is people being able to know who you are. So we've talked before, and I know the Institute does in terms of its values, about, yep. you know, good leadership development captures mm-hmm. that triangle of what you know,
yep.
you know, and that's taught in business schools. We all know that. and probably an overused muscle, my brain. Mm. We've got great, capable people out there, but are not necessarily leaders. What I can do, mm-hmm. which is, you know, how skilled am I around delegation, team leadership? But I think increasingly people want to know. So the third leg of the stool is who are you?
Ooh, yeah.
Do people really know? And we don't trust people who mm-hmm. don't have a level of authenticity. And that doesn't mean to say you have to be transparent, that your life is on show, mm-hmm. Because people also, another one of those tensions, expect a bit of distance between yourself. This is not about being the most popular person. It's not about being everyone's friend.
Yep.
People kind of knowing that you are actually showing up mm-hmm. as who you are. And so I think that's just another one of those tensions to manage. So I think authenticity for me is that proxy for, do I trust you?
That's really interesting, because of course that speaks very strongly to what you said earlier about context
mm.
and the importance of it. In a way, I suppose we're talking about almost context-specific authenticity. So we're not faking it, but actually we all have different personalities. And actually, I guess the people we are working with in leadership terms sometimes require us to be different in the way that we engage with them. Is that fair, do you think?
I think that's very fair and a great insight, John, because people expect us as leaders to be quite skillful mm-hmm. at being able to deploy, as I say, a repertoire of skills. Sometimes yep. we need to be. Sometimes command and control is appropriate, and yep. we need to be able to show up and deliver that mm-hmm. Because that's what the situation requires. Sometimes we have to, you know, overuse the compassion muscle, but these aren't autopilots. These are things we are intentional and deliberate about. Doesn't make us fake. It means mm-hmm. we are skillful as leaders because we're really assessing the situation. Sometimes we need to sanction others. We need to use our power to, you know, and again, that word, how well do we exercise our power? How skillfully? Yeah. And sometimes we need to pull rank. But do we know when we're doing that and for what purpose? So sometimes we do need to sanction. If there is bad behavior and we're in a leadership position, mm-hmm. people will be watching, as you say, our teams, our bosses, our peers, our followers are watching to see mm-hmm. whether we're able to deploy a range of leadership capabilities. And that doesn't make us fake.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's a couple of things that spring to mind, a couple of quotes. One of them is, you can fool the people you work for. You can fool the people you work with. You can't fool the people who work for you.
Yeah,
because the people who work for us, they see who we really are.
Yeah. It's like walking around with a loud hailer and a spotlight on you all the time, which is hard because yep. you're under scrutiny all the time. But that yep. goes with the territory, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, the other thing I was thinking about is a definition of power. I saw a really nice one once, which is force under control. And I thought, yeah, actually, that's right. Because the, in a sense, the essence of leadership is understanding how to control the force that we possess, whether it's authoritative because of hierarchy, or it's actually just the influence we have on, on people.
Because, the how things get done are through people exercising their power. And, you know, a lot of people go, oh, that's awful. But a power doesn't need to be corrupting. You know, we get to choose how we exercise our power. Do we do that with integrity? Do we do it with skill? Are we masterful about it? Because when we are leaders, when we are managers, whether we like it or not, we have been gifted this power.
Yes.
Because we have a seniority that goes with that. So it's up to us to be skillful about it. And it's not about controlling. It's not about lording over others. It's about, you know, operating with integrity, given we have been given that gift of power.
Very interesting. And this word choice is really very important, because we are given the choice of how we distribute or dispense, or however it is, apply that power. There'd be quite a lot of shift. You talked about the repertoire of leadership skills that we all have, and for example, compassionate leadership having been ascendant over parts of the pandemic period, for example. I suppose the leadership quality which is ascendant tends to change over time in certain markets, in certain sectors, in certain contexts and things like this. Why do you think that is? Because there should, in theory, there should be a sort of clear and unequivocal foundation of leadership qualities and stuff. Yes. And yet, of course, we change what we expect from leaders.
Yes, because I do think leadership, we're very vested in leadership in every part of our life. It makes us feel safe. It makes us feel purposeful. It gives us meaning. It gives us a sense of belonging, because we've got a leader who tells us we're part of the tribe. So we're very vested in it. So we look for things that are important to us. So it's sort of understandable that the type of leadership, or where the gravity sort of goes, is reflected in the social, political, and cultural requirements of its time, because we are so vested in leadership, political leadership, organizational, family leadership. You know, so we bring to it, again, quite unconsciously often, what we need when we are feeling a particular level of either insecurity. We need different types of leadership. The challenge is that we need leaders who are able to understand the context, really bring wisdom to that, and then deploy their leadership in a non-linear binary way. Okay, oh, well, you know, we need this. All right, we're just going to do command and control. We're just going to tell everyone what to do. Because that doesn't work as well. As you know, we need to be able to be much more nuanced around that. But there are some people who have, we all have natural strengths. And again, that's a real skill of leadership. Do we know our strengths? How do we play to them? How do we manage them? And how do we bring a team around us of people who complement that? But yeah, I think it's because it reflects the huge importance that leadership has across every level to all of us in our lives.
Yeah, indeed. And we keep coming back, I guess, to this principle of context and the requirements of leadership in context. Let's think a little bit about your specialization, if I can call it that, around women in leadership. And we've been, I guess, as a leadership community, we've been aware for some years of the need to promote women in leadership, not least because there's quite a lot of research, Harvard Business Review and all sorts of other people, that shows actually women in leadership can provide a competitive advantage for organizations. Why do you think there's still work to be done in supporting women into leadership positions when the evidence clearly demonstrates why?
You're absolutely right, John. I think, you know, no one is doing the business case anymore. That was all done 25, 20 years ago. You know, that whole business case. Everyone knows that what we need is really good leaders. So we have to throw the net out as widely as possible. And, you know, there's not a CEO that I talk to who isn't pulling his or her air out if they have it, which is like, why can't I bring my talented women through? So it's glacial. We thought it was all done 25 years ago. You know, there it was very different. So mm-hmm. the roadblocks have gone, but the speed bumps have not. And why is that? Right. You know, because it is so glacial, and we're still, people go, oh, you know, that's old hat, you know, or, you know, this is why women aren't in leadership. They, you know, opt out when they have kids, or they don't negotiate well, or they're not as confident, and all of this mythology. And I think it really behoves us. And that's been my interest, having spent most of my career as either the first woman in a leadership role or the only woman in the room, to try and understand what that was, and then to get steeped in the research around this, not to create victims, not to create entitlement or special measures, but again, to be, how do we become skillful? And the real challenge for women in leadership is what I call this double bind. You know, that's at the heart of it. Still, only six CEOs of Britain's 100 biggest companies are women. And yet we've been at this, you know, for 25 years. So what's going on? It really is a result of outdated stereotypes and social conditioning. Right. When we think still, and you think, oh, isn't this over? But stereotypes take a long time to atrophy. And the think leader, think male stereotype is very much baked in most of our brains. And that is a real challenge. So what does that mean? And you think, oh, surely not. But still today, you know, if you go into a school, ask 17-year-old boys and girls to draw a leader, they're likely to draw a man. And most of these boys and girls have had professional working mothers. So, you know, for millennia, men have been in charge. You know, it, and those stereotypes take a long time to atrophy. Right. So if we're thinking leader, think male. And those stereotypes associated with leadership being traditionally associated with stereotypical male qualities, that means the more senior women become, as we, these subtle biases, as women start to exercise their, what we call agency, which is important, authority, directness, assertiveness, confidence, it gets noisy for them. And they can get pushback or, so their double bind is that, this tension between our leader role, which is still seen as primarily male, and our gender role. So women have this trade-off between their competence and their likability in leadership. And that's not a trade-off that men need to make. So things like ambition, confidence, self-sufficiency and dominance, they have women kind of acting or behaving counter-stereotypically. Now you'd say, oh, all these stereotypes are, you know, so out of date. They are out of date, but they're still in the machinery of our minds. And they diminish men as well. You know, to say men take charge and women take care, how patronizing. The most compassionate men, the, you know, my greatest allies have been men. And we still know that for men to ask for flexible working is much more career limiting for them than it is for women. So, you know, for, it does no one any favors, but we just have to hack the machine, the machinery of our minds, because what that does mean is those speed bumps mean great performance doesn't result in high potential ratings for women. Confident women are not seen as the same leadership material as confident men. So confident, assertive behavior in women does not result in influence, whereas it does in men. Women or minorities don't get actionable feedback. It's called protective hesitancy, with the best intentions in the world. But I mean, if you're not getting that all your career, how can you, you know, women's expertise is challenged more than men and listened to less. So all of these things, women are interrupted more. And this isn't an evil plot by men to keep women out of boardrooms. These are unconscious. They are things that, that these are trade-offs that men don't need to navigate in their leadership world. Women pay a modesty penalty if they negotiate for themselves, or if they advocate for themselves. So if you're not doing that, or, you know, people say, oh, well, women just need to ask. It's not that they don't know how to negotiate, because when women advocate on somebody else's behalf, they are really successful. Some data research shows actually more successful than men, but they will get pushback or penalized if they ask for themselves, because it's counter-stereotypical to what we think women should do. Old stuff, but still very real. So that's the challenge. And I believe that's at the heart, this double bind between our gender role and our leader role. Mm-hmm. How do we manage it? How do we mitigate it through deliberate practice? Mm-hmm. Do we really understand it? And it's not to say, John, that the system doesn't need to change. This is not about, oh, let's fix the girls or teach, you know, get, you know, or yell at the boys. And it's not about making women feel, you know, bad or men feel bad or creating victims. Really unfortunate, because all of this is about development and learning. If you feel like a victim, you cannot learn. And so it's not also about making women behave more like men, because that doesn't work.
Absolutely.
It's about how do we, you know, none of these, I absolutely believe, John, none of these obstacles are insurmountable. And you'd say, well, it's not fair. Why should I have to master that? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of life isn't fair. But at this stage of our social evolution, what will accelerate women into leadership is being able to become more skillful about that, knowing what's going on out there, understanding the environment, knowing what's going on in here. Because sometimes our own socialization as women can diminish our authority. Mm-hmm. Women apologize a lot more, use softening language. This is all stuff we've learned to do.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean to say it's bad. I don't want to stop anyone apologizing. For when they need to apologize, that's when it's powerful, as opposed to sprinkling it through everything. Our own autopilots can really get in the way. So it's about understanding again, how do I want to show up? And how can I do that? How are people experiencing my leadership? And how can I bring authority and warmth to being my best leadership self without doing my head in, without it burning me out, without me getting really angry and resentful? Because we've all seen examples, all of us, you know, women who decide, oh, well, my competence and likability, women who become even more masculine than the men. She's great at her job, but really don't like her. And, you know, and as role models, they're not role models, because no one wants to be like that person.
Absolutely.
You know? And then other women who are really likable, help everything, do that. I think, gosh, she's really nice, but, you know, not really leadership material. So, you know, that trade-off about how do I bring agency and warmth into my leadership? And that's not necessarily what we learn in business schools.
No.
And, you know, but they're not insurmountable. And I believe, you know, why should we need to do that? Well, what will change these stereotypes is when we have more women in leadership. And I do it for all the women coming behind me that want to see women in leadership acting with integrity, being authentic, comfortable in their own skin, masterful. And then that will accelerate women in leadership, because all the women coming behind us will see it and therefore know that they can be it.
That's excellent. And there are two things that stand out really strongly in there. One of this is the last point that you made, which is about role modeling. And I think confidently role modeling the leadership skills that actually women in inverted commas need to role model. And they're the same leadership skills as we would expect for men, because it's leadership that we want to see demonstrated. The confident role modeling of that by women is the first thing. The second thing is, how do we, as a sort of a whole mainstream of leaders, how do we promote that confident role modeling by women leaders? And I think it requires all of us as a leadership community, because frankly, our job as leaders, my definition of leadership is to achieve an outcome that cannot be better achieved any other way. Now, if we're wasting half of the population and trying to achieve that, then we're not being good leaders. So I think we all have a responsibility to promote that confident role modeling when we see it.
I agree. And some of those, you know, the things that, you know, that those outdated stereotypes are very subtle, but they can be mitigated through deliberate action. Small things. Yep. I've seen huge differences just in how every leader, meeting courtesy, you know, just track airtime, you know, because women, you know, ask everyone for 2 seconds when you go around the room to say what they're really proud of, men and women. You know, we're getting normalizing women talking about themselves and what they're proud of, getting practice doing it, and everyone starts to get used to it. You know, if someone gets interrupted, just go, yep, can I just see that, you know, that point that Jane was going to, let's let Jane finish with that. Just being able to go around, amplify when we're looking at evaluations. You know, women aren't, you know, ask them to explicitly say, what are your leadership aspirations?
Yes.
Because, you know, just ask. Men will tell you. And often I've had managers, I had no idea she was interested in that role. Because it's not that they can't, but they have learned that there's a modesty penalty. If I look like I'm boasting, if I look like I'm showing off, if I look like I'm ambitious, you know, when you say he's an ambitious leader, and when you say, she's ambitious, you know, it's like it's got an edge because we're looking at it through the lens of what we think is stereotypical female behavior. It's hard. So women get this noise, you know, should I? It's not that they can't negotiate, but they've learned to read the situation, so there will be a social cost to me doing that. So I will pull back. So being skillful with that and being able to, as people in the room, men and women, to be part of that solution and to sort of master the hacks that just get used to, you know, all of the things that that can undermine, even, you know, that the competence, you know, women, you know, men are perceived still to be competent unless proved otherwise. Women are in this prove it again, prove it again. And so even that can lead to working on all the really hard stuff, the wrong stuff. You know, women are 44% more likely to be asked to volunteer for things because we see things as, you know, so they have a higher standard of what communal, pro-social, caring behavior looks like. But if they're all non-promotable tasks, and of course not everything is about promotion. We all want to be good citizens, but if they're spending more time doing that, and then they're likely to take longer to progress. So just being mindful of it and not asking for volunteers, make sure everyone's sharing the load.
Absolutely, because to a degree, it is a sort of zero-sum game because each of us only has a certain amount of ourselves that we can give to anything. And just thinking about the hacks that you mentioned, networks are one of the things often quoted as being responsible for men and their ability to progress up the career ladder and stuff like this. How do you think aspiring women leaders can utilize networks and contacts to position themselves for leadership?
Really important, because whether we like it or not, visibility is the most important contributor to our progression. It has been absolutely determined, research and data point after data point. And often I find women find that really, oh, but shouldn't my work speak for itself? And so they'll work harder and harder and then find these people getting promoted over them because they feel that, you know, talking, advocating for themselves, getting stretch assignments that aren't core to their work, networking, you know, is just sort of tacky and a bit of a waste of time. It's sort of like you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And, you know, my work should speak for itself. Of course your work should, but there gets to a stage in our career where actually we need to be throwing our scanning out further. And relationships are really important. And the nature of relationships are they atrophy unless we pay attention to them. And still, in terms of getting jobs, weak ties, really interesting work that Herminia Barra has done, weak ties. So I think for me, the skill set and mindset shifts that are there for women around visibility raising are around, don't think of networking as some tacky affair. Think of it, you know, you can shift your mindset around it. What am I here to do? You know, how can I remember, you know, all those years ago when people were doing physical networking and I would go into a sort of a sea of, you know, with your cards in those days, really old school, into a sea of gray suited men and feel really uncomfortable. And I remember thinking one time, you know, when I flipped it to, if these people, and there was always someone around the room looking really uncomfortable, clutching that warm glass of bad wine and probably thinking, what am I doing here? I said, I put on my to-do list. I had to go to a network. But, you know, really was not there with any intention or purpose. And so if this was my home, I would never leave someone in a corner. looking uncomfortable. So, okay, I'm just going to go and make them comfortable. I'm going to ask them about them. And it completely flipped as opposed to, you know, I didn't take over like I was the host. But there are some things, you know, what did networking, those relationships gave me? Learning, being able to connect dots, be able to see the environment, be able to be of help to others. So it's not all about what you can do for me. So just go into networking with curiosity, with genuine curiosity. It really has to be part of your day job. And so do a really good audit of your network. You know, I love Ibarra's work around three types of network: personal, operational, and strategic. And very often women on their own just don't work on the strategic. That is your future. These are people, and people want to help. You would be surprised. You know, even mentors, go get a mentor. They're so critical for your career. You know, people reaching out and say, do you have 15 minutes for a coffee? You don't have to say, will you be my mentor? I need, I'm really interested in the sector. Would you have 15 to 20 minutes to talk about how I might be able to bring my marketing function into that sector? Or I'm a marketing professional. You're an HR director. Would you have 15 to 20 minutes to talk to me about how I can bring my marketing expertise perhaps into HR? You're not saying, I want a job in your business. I mean, that is tacky. Just learn, be curious, and find out as much about them. And, you know, networking is really important. Those contacts, they're just about building relationships of value.
That's absolutely brilliant. And I love that, that basic principle of curiosity, because I now often think about networking as just mutually beneficial conversations. But actually, even more powerful to think of it is, actually, I'm curious. I'm curious. I'll go and find out, because people love to talk about themselves, of course.
They do. Yes, once you talk like to give advice. Yeah. They really do. And so it doesn't have to be broad brush. Be intentional and deliberate, because our time, as you say, our time and energy is precious. But just be curious. And but it does need to be somewhere, the more senior we become, that it needs to be where we spend our time.
It needs to be thoughtfully done. That's absolutely right. Well, this is a tremendously valuable conversation, Penny. I'm sure for all of our listeners and things. We've come to the inevitable top tip question, really, as we always have at the end. So what would be your top tip for an organization wanting to ensure that it doesn't miss out on the competitive advantage of supporting women into leadership?
Yes, a top tip. Because I've probably painted a complex picture and people go, oh, where do you start? I think I would start, John, with your senior women and men, especially in the C-suite, are part of the solution, not part of the problem. Because a lot, you know, and get them to say, what are they doing really well now? Get some hacks in their meeting management tone. You know, they can be such an amplifier. And this is not about special measures. This is just about leveling the playing field and really understand it. Inquire. Ask them, how does it feel to be a woman in leadership? Again, curiosity. And maybe go out and experience what it feels like to be in the minority every now and then. Because if we're not, we swim in that soup and we don't know what it feels like. So personalize it. And if I may, for the organizations, for the individuals, individual leaders, and maybe those women, you know, in the institute, at the institute, who are aspiring to or already in management and leadership, this isn't insurmountable. This is not about having to be a fake or being inauthentic or not operating with authenticity or integrity, but it does require being skillful. And managing the double bind is something that if we do well and skillful and put energy and mastery into, will have a huge impact on the capability and quality of leadership that the world has never needed more, and leave a real legacy for the women coming behind us.
Oh, Penny, that's absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much indeed. And I think I take from this the role of the Institute in this actually is to promote the getting away from that deficit model that talks about victims and seeking to promote the opportunity model, which says the opportunity exists. Deploy the leadership skills that enable you to deliver actually on behalf of yourself. And I think there's an enormous amount we can do. That's great. Well, Penny, thank you very much indeed. That's it to everybody listening. Thank you very much for joining us today. My special thanks to our guest, Penny DeValk, and to you, the audience, for listening. Please do join the conversation via social media using hashtag Leadership at the Edge, or send a voice message via the podcast page on Anchor. For more of our podcasts and events and lots of other content, visit the website at www.institutelm.com. Subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and mention us to your colleagues. Thank you, everyone, for listening.